E is brought to you by the University of Delaware Partnership for Public Education. In an effort to increase the availability and accessibility of UD expertise to Delaware's P-12 educators, leaders, and policy influencers, we have invited faculty members from the University of Delaware's 9 colleges to share their research. We hope you enjoy today's critical conversation and consider ways you might be able to leverage relevant research and UD expertise to advance policy and transform practice.
Parenting is everywhere these days, on our feeds, in our group chat, and at the center of so many cultural conversations. Today, we invite Dr. Michelle Lobo, an associate professor of physical therapy at the University of Delaware, to talk about how effective parent education programs on play and physical movement can bolster early learning and development, and what early educators and research professionals can do to better support families in their work. We will discuss how parents can make changes in their daily activities to enhance their children's movement and thinking abilities. So let's jump in. Hi, Dr. Lobo. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. Your research is really interesting. It focuses on parent education programs that can support early development for children. So could you tell us more about your work, like how you're creating parent education programs, about how to interact and play with babies? How did that start? How did you see the need for this type of education?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here today. I have been working with families for almost 30 years now as a pediatric physical therapist. So as a clinician, like an early intervention provider, and also in my research. And one thing that I've consistently found is that parents are really not sure what to do with babies. And it doesn't matter how much education we have. People don't really know what to do with babies all day. We've done surveys with parents, and almost all of them say that they're looking for information about what to do to support their baby's development. And so they primarily look for this information online. That's what got me very interested in recognizing that there's a need that's not being filled by healthcare providers, by early educators. Instead, people are getting information online from whomever is willing to put the information out there. So the quality often varies. So as a clinician, a pediatric physical therapist, I'm especially interested in parent education because we do know that approximately 20% of children, young children, have developmental delays, but only about 20% of those kids are receiving early intervention services for those delays in the first couple of years of life. That's my real motivation for working with parent education, is that I want to support parents of all children.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yes, I remember when I had my baby, I was like, I went to graduate school, but I don't know how much tummy time that I should have.
Yeah, and a lot of parents tell you they're waiting because as adults, we don't remember what it's like to be a young child. And so we are waiting for the things that we can relate to. Yes. And I hear parents often say a lot, well, and then when they start walking and they can play ball with me and they can talk, then I will do more with them. But before that, we're not really sure what to do. And it's as a developmental scientist and someone who's very interested in infant development, I think it's just amazing what babies are accomplishing in the first year of life. So pointing that out to parents and talking about how you can change the little things that you do each day, like carrying your baby, interacting with your baby, how you put your baby down to play when you have to get things done on your own around the house. Just small changes in your daily routine can be enriched in ways that can support development for children. And parents really appreciate learning about those types of things.
Yes, that's very important, I think. I just did diaper change, but I didn't really think about the processes that were included in changing a diaper or giving a bath, even though those are very essential needs and very basic needs that babies all share.
And something that you're doing so many times a day.
Yes.
So if you change it up just a little bit and you talk to your baby about what you're going to do as you're getting yes. ready to change their diaper and the things that they're seeing. And then you provide them an opportunity to maybe hold a toy during the process and feel an object and learn about it. Or you provide them an opportunity to be on their tummy for a couple of minutes after each time. There are just little things that you can do that help give your baby opportunities to learn about their own body, about the world around them, about communication. So yes. Parents appreciate that kind of information.
Yes. And I think the fact that you mentioned where parents seek information about raising a child, it also resonated a lot because I see a lot of parents seeking advice on social media or popular platforms. So that dissemination piece is really critical too.
Yeah. And when parents look for information, they're looking in a variety of places, right? Like sometimes they're looking to professional organizations like the CDC or the American Academy of Pediatrics or the Mayo Clinic. They're also looking to social media. And no matter where they're looking, what we found, we did a whole content analysis of the apps, and we found that most of the information, interestingly enough, is really just telling parents what's going to happen. So it's listing out milestones.
Yes.
And that is helpful for parents in one level, right? But it doesn't empower them in a way that giving them information about developmental process does. Mm-hmm. And I think that the reason we do that is because the very earliest parent education efforts were really from the published efforts in the US were from the Parent Teacher Association, the PTA. Wow. And that started over 125 years ago.
Wow.
And there were a lot of other parent education efforts after that. But what we were doing was really just trying to document what was happening and when, right? So we were documenting the what and the when, but the really interesting part of developmental science has really happened in the last maybe 50 years, right? Where we're starting to ask how and understand more about how what you've done in the seconds, the minutes, the weeks, and the months leading up to that milestone have actually enabled you to achieve that milestone. So it's not just that we're waiting for a timer to go off and neural development to happen, but we can actually empower parents to help kids get ready walking in the first month of life, right? We can help parents get kids ready to communicate and to speak and understand language in utero, right? When we're reading to them and we're speaking to them. So that is really, it's exciting as a therapist who tries to advance development.
Yes.
And it's exciting for parents. Because then they know that they're really important in their child's developmental outcomes.
Yes, that's true. And so there are a lot of developmental domains in child development. So in what ways and can physical movement help children's learning and development? Why is it important?
Yeah, so across the lifespan, we're starting to recognize that movement plays a really important role in thinking, in communication, you know, the types of gestures you use and how you're using them. It's really important for your memory. So that's part of the learning and the thinking process across the lifespan. Movement plays a key role. In very early development, it's such an interesting time because kids are learning things for the very first time.
Yes.
Things that we take for granted, you know, like dressing yourself and standing and sitting and walking around or feeding yourself, doing all of these things, they're learning for the first time. I always equate it to like us being dropped off on an alien planet.
Yes.
And they have different objects all around you. And movement is so important for them because it's a way that they can explore and learn about these things. They can bring themselves to people. They can turn their head to look at something that somebody is naming. So they understand that, oh, every time the person says that word, they're talking about that thing that we're both looking at. Mm-hmm. They can sit up and get a different view of the world and start to play with objects and figure out that you can use some as tools to make other things happen with other objects. They're learning all of that through this physical trial and error experience. Mm-hmm. So just learning that, oh, I can hold my own head up and I can turn it to look at things happening in the world, or I can open and I can close my hands for the very first time. And then I can change my grip and my orientation, my hand to hold different types of objects and feel different objects and learn about their properties. So much is happening in the first, and a lot of it is really driven by movement. So that's why I'm very interested in movement, and not just for sake, but for what movement gives you, right? The opportunities for learning that movement gives you.
Yes, I think I saw a documentary talking about how babies starting to stand up, like that, the spatial difference changes their perspectives as well. And that was so fascinating too.
Yeah, and even moving, if someone pushes you in a stroller, you don't learn the same type of spatial information that you would learn if you were moving yourself. If you're controlling it, you learn so much more about where things are in space around you. It's almost like, you know, you being the driver versus being the passenger in a car. Mm-hmm. When kids are the drivers, they learn in a different way.
Wow, that is very fascinating. So I think your current project, Babies Excelling Strategically Through Play Program, how do you envision this best play program supporting parents, educators, early intervention providers, and babies? There are a lot of stakeholders here.
Yeah. So I've been really lucky to get funding from donors to the University of Delaware through the Maggie Newman Health Sciences Research Fund and the PT Mobility Development Fund to create a parent education program for parents who have babies from birth up through walking. And I have suggestions in there that are based on evidence and key ingredients that are supported for advancing development scientifically, to ways that parents can hold, position, play, and interact with their babies at different stages of development. So I'm putting that together now, and then we'll be trying it out with families to make sure that it meets their needs and it's usable for them, and to see if it helps support kids' development. We've done a pilot test of it where parents received education at one point in time between 3 and 5 months of age for their infant. And then they tried the activities for a month. And we found that with that pilot test, that kids with typical development had advanced movement and thinking development after 4 weeks, whereas kids with developmental delays had advanced movement development after 4 weeks. And we think that if parents have access to this type of education more longitudinally across the first year or so until their kids are walking, that we'll see even greater benefits for them. So that's what the goal of this Best Play program is to support parents. Again, parents of all infants can benefit. Mm-hmm. And the target audience is broad, because we see this as a universal education. It can be beneficial to everybody.
So do you think like parents can do a preliminary assessment of how their babies are moving? After this parent engagement program, would they still need early intervention specialists?
Yeah. So this is a program that could supplement early intervention. So it's not meant to be a substitute for early intervention. We do know that for many kids with developmental delays, if they have effective interventions, that they outgrow those delays in this program. There are other children who might have more persistent or more significant needs, like children with cerebral palsy, for instance. And in those cases, this might be helpful to them before they've been diagnosed, or if they have been diagnosed and are already receiving early intervention services. These activities can be beneficial for anybody. Does that make sense?
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. And I think you mentioned it a little bit already, but like, what can this Best Play program offer for families whose babies are developing typically? And what can it offer for families whose babies might have some delays in their development? Because the program was universal, right?
So one thing that it does is it gives parents something fun to do with their children that can be beneficial for their children's development, right? Parents like to know why they're doing things and what might be the potential outcomes. So that can be empowering to parents. And then developmentally, We've seen really nice benefits for kids with typical development. We've seen improvements in movements and thinking and problem solving for those kids. And then for kids who have developmental delays or are risk for developmental delays, we've seen in shorter term tests, we've seen improvements in their movement abilities. But we expect that with time, those improvements in movement would hopefully also lead to other types of thinking improvements and problem solving improvements.
Could you give an example of play activity or a strand of this program that we can imagine?
Yeah, so I'll give you a couple of examples that contrast what we see very commonly things that involve like passive movement of the baby. So it might say bicycle your baby's legs, right? Mm. In this program, we're very focused on children actively moving their own bodies. So problem solving how to move your own body. So instead of passively bicycling your baby's legs, we might say hang toys over your baby's legs. Babies reach earlier with their feet than they do with their hands for toys. And so can give your baby opportunities to kick a toy, to see it move, to hear it make sounds. And then they start learning about cause and effect while they're also learning to control their leg movements. That would be one example. Another example would be that we often find in the typical education suggestions to read a book to your baby. Mm-hmm. And it's a really nice recommendation.
Yes.
But just changing the words a little bit can change the way that parents do it. If I'm told to read a book with my baby, what we found is that parents often hold the book where the baby can't touch it. They're reading it to the baby, just reading the words that are on the page, but not really giving the baby opportunities to respond and look at certain things on the page or touch them. So if you just change that up and you suggest, instead of reading a book to your baby, share a book with your baby. Mm. And you give parents suggestions about how to do that, right? Letting the baby turn the pages, feel the pages, look at what your baby's looking at on the page and talk about that thing. You don't necessarily have to read the whole story through from front to back, but you can just talk about the pictures you're seeing that the baby's paying attention to, describe what's happening. Then that it can be a little bit more beneficial for parents trying to interact with a book with younger children.
Yeah. That sounds beautiful. It's like whole experience of reading a book rather than reading the words.
Yes.
Yes. I'm also curious about parents' responses when you disseminate this kind of knowledge and talk about novel ways to interact with their babies.
Yeah, parents, they get very excited about having ideas. It's really fun to see your baby learn something for the first time or an engagement activity for the first time. It's fun for me as a researcher or a clinician, but it's really exciting for parents. Interestingly enough, parents are excited to have any type of advice about how to play with babies compared to typical education, which would be like these general types of tips and suggestions. And parents, we ask them to rate things like how easy was it to do the activities? How fun were the activities? They rated both of the education programs, both of the groups rated them really highly. So that told us that parents are really yearning for this type of information, and they really value the information, whether it is of lower quality or higher quality in terms of matching the scientific recommendations, and that it's not harder for them to do a play intervention program that is more scientifically evidenced, right? People just really want suggestions about what to do with their babies, and they welcome any type of suggestion.
Yes, hanging toys in the baby's legs, it doesn't really cost you a lot of money or efforts, time, but these kind of like micro changes that will have impact, right? So that's what we're actually hoping.
Exactly.
Online, there's so many information, but as a parent, you also do not know which information or advice is right for your baby, because every baby is also different.
Yes.
So that kind of parent engagement, I think, is very essential.
Yeah, and I think it's important to be very aware of that. As you mentioned, not every suggestion is appropriate for every baby, but it's also not appropriate for every parent. I try to be really conscious about that. But then what we're really trying to do is educate parents about the principles.
Mm.
And if they can think of another way to give their baby that opportunity that's more interesting to them and their baby or more agreeable and acceptable to them, then that's great. And I also am very careful about not saying you should do this.
Mm. Yes.
So this is the thing you should do. This is something that you could do
okay.
with your baby, right?
Yes. Yeah, those kind of wording is also very important piece that I imagine.
Parents already have a lot of guilt, right? We always feel like we're not doing a good enough job, that we should be doing better. So it's important not to put pressure on parents and make them feel like this is something you have to do for your baby to have positive developmental outcomes, or which of these things works well within your routine, which ideas do you like, and which ones are you thinking, I can't do that, I don't have the bandwidth to do that. That's all okay. Not making people feel bad, like mm-hmm. their baby's going to be missing out on something if mm-hmm. they don't do it.
That really warms my heart. Thank you for doing that. About parent engagement, I think you mentioned a little bit. What do you think is important to remember when engaging parents or conducting parent education in research? Because, you know, in education or other child development relevant research fields, we do a lot of work with parents and families.
So I come at this with a unique perspective because I'm a pediatric physical therapist, right? So I'm always very family-centered. I've made some things for people like wearable solutions for rehabilitation for young kids. Wow. And so I have always used a user-centered design approach. And so that's the way I think of engaging parents in my research, is from a user-centered design process.
Okay.
So the first thing is that as scientists, we often think about what we feel like the need is or the important question is to answer. And in my experience, it's much better to go to the end users, right, which would be our parents in this example, and asking, what questions do you have? What needs do you have? Trying to do interviews and focus groups and trying to figure out what are the important things that we should be working on. That's the first thing, so that you know that your solution or your answer that you're going to be getting is something that's going to be actually meaningful for people, not just something you thought would be meaningful for them. So that's the first thing. And then to keep involving them throughout the process, because otherwise you think you're getting to the solution that they want, but you might have veered off track. So getting their input along the way. And then just because families are all different, you know, we have very different belief systems within different cultures in our own country here, but then also across the globe. It's really important not to make assumptions about people mm-hmm. and not to make judgments about people.
Okay.
So really trying to understand what families want in terms of education, instead of just providing them with education, trying to figure out when they're ready to receive information. Do they want that information? What type of information do they want? What do they value in their life? Because if they value something and you're telling them, oh, never do this or don't do that, you know, that they're just going to feel like, oh, this person doesn't understand me. So it's really important to really understand each family and what their needs are and what their value system is and how you can work within that value system to support them and their babies.
Yes, that's very important. Do you also reflect their opinions or those kind of values in the like experiments too, in the intervention programs?
Yeah. So as I'm making this intervention program, again, I'm trying to make it sort of a menu of items, right? And you can select what things work for you. And if you don't agree with something, you don't have to do that. I'm also trying to avoid things that I know are sort of culturally sensitive topics. So things like using certain types of containers. So we're sharing information about infant equipment or containers, but I know there are very stark contrasting views about, for instance, using walkers. Here in the US, we very strongly advise against using them, the American Academy of Pediatrics. So instead of, whereas other cultures I know they're very commonly used, right? Rather than making a judgment that's going to make somebody feel bad about their choice or make them feel like they can't be honest about their choice, because they have to not let their healthcare professionals or whoever it might be know that they've made this choice. Why is the American Academy of Pediatrics concerned about using walkers? It's because kids can now reach things that they couldn't reach before. Mm. So they could pull hot items off of the stove and get burned, or they could fall downstairs. So just making parents aware of those dangers, maybe. So just stating those facts, but not making a recommendation about you should or you should not use them. So I'm trying to be careful about those things. I'm also very careful about issues related to socioeconomic status, right? Yes. Making sure that we are making recommendations that would be feasible for people regardless of the space that they have and the toys available. So always giving recommendations for household items that might be more commonly encountered and how you could use those instead of toys for infants to get the same types of learning opportunities that we're talking about.
Yes.
Those are some ways that I've been trying to involve input from people and what we've learned from people about their needs across time.
Oh, yeah, thank you so much for sharing those insights. When you also want to transfer new findings or knowledge, how can we be more sensitive and responsive to each family when giving recommendations or writing policy suggestions?
Yeah, that's difficult because usually when you're doing something on a big scale like that,
yes,
you are writing more for the general population, right? Or the targeted population, but not for the individual.
Yes.
Right? That's okay to do, to have these recommendations, or just like we do with our milestones, right? We report expected milestones for 50% or 75% of the population usually does this at this age, right? But I do think one thing that's important to consider too, right, is letting parents know about variability. Because even, you know, every time we do a study, some of the people in the group behave one way, but then other people behave like the control group did, even though they were in the intervention group. Or some people in the control group look like they received the intervention, but they didn't. And then our average doesn't reflect any one true baby most of the time, right? So I think just being honest about these things too, so parents are not, they're not feeling frantic if or stressed out if their kid's not doing something, or if there's a risk factor for a negative outcome, right? Giving the right perspective to parents and not making them feel so scared. The reality is, for kids with typical development, development is pretty robust about how to disseminate information effectively. I will tell you that parents, when we ask them about how they like to receive information, they really like bullet points. Like if we're sharing information online, they don't want stories, long paragraphs. They want bullet points. They want videos. They prefer actual videos and pictures. So they want us to kind of get to the point and make it sort of in an entertaining
manner
that we share it. So that might be one suggestion, though, if you want people to actually pay attention and see your
results.
Don't write a long jargon-filled statement, right? Even a statement that's not filled with jargon. Just get to the key points and maybe even share it in the form of a video.
Yes, I can imagine that. Like, we're busy.
Yes.
So I think you also mentioned like early intervention providers. Have you worked with educators and early interventionists too? Like collaborated with them along with parents?
Yeah. So I have early intervention providers that I'm working with now for the development of my best plays. So I run ideas by them and then they give me feedback about what they think. And always on our studies, I have my providers in the community who serve as assessors or intervention providers in my research studies. So I try to keep close connections. I also have a network of pediatric providers that I work with through that course as well. Yeah, so I try to keep up with things that are happening. And so I like doing talks and continuing education courses to stay in touch with the needs of clinicians who are working with families.
So in that line of question, what role do you see an early intervention providers playing in making that best play program a success?
Yeah, so it's interesting because most of what early educators, intervention providers do is educating parents, because most children who are at risk of having a delay might be followed with evaluations maybe every 6 months, every 3 months if they have more funding. Mm-hmm. But in between that time, parents are on their own usually. So also, if they're receiving active services, it's not like you're getting services 5 days a week from individuals.
Yes.
So a big part of your job in early childhood care is providing information to parents about what they can do each day. So this is something, the Best Play program is written in a manner that talks to parents or caregivers, but it's really the principles that are there are ones that can benefit early intervention providers, early educators, anyone who's working with families. So they could take these suggestions and use them with kids and with families to help educate the families that they're working with, or to adapt it, expand on it, think of their own ways to meet the sort of the key ingredients of the intervention on their own. So that is an important way that people, the Best Play program, can support people who are working with young kids.
Thank you for the insights. I can see a lot of people working together for children.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for joining today. I really appreciate all the great work and the insights. Thank you so much, Dr. Lobo.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's episode of Evidence for Education. A huge thank you to Dr. Michelle Lobo for sharing her insights on how effective and responsive parent education programs can promote our young children's learning and development. If today's discussion resonated with you, let's keep the conversation going. Share this episode and follow our podcast to stay updated on future conversations. You can find more details about today's episode, our guest, and additional resources from the University of Delaware's Partnership for Public Education in the show notes. Thank you for tuning in to E4E. We'll see you next time.